5. South Africa's President Jacob Zuma says his country will mourn but also celebrate the life of Nelson Mandela.
We'll always love Madiba for teaching us that it is possible to overcome hatred and anger. Nelson
Mandela! Outside his home in Johannesburg, people have spent the day dancing and singing. Here, tributes to the former leader have been paid at Mr. Mandela's statue in Parliament Square in central London. Joanna Vignola hopes his legacy lives on.
What I want now is for the whole continent of Africa, all those other people who can't see their way through to making a difference, I want them to wake up and be inspired by him and say to themselves, actually, I'm not afraid.
Meanwhile, a vigil's planned in around an hour's time in central London, and details have also been released of Nelson Mandela's memorial service in Johannesburg next Tuesday, followed by his funeral a week on Sunday. A Royal Marine who killed an injured insurgent in Afghanistan has been sentenced to a minimum of 10 years. Sergeant Alexander Wayne Blackman's name was made public for the first time yesterday. He shot the man in the chest in 2011. The Energy Secretary admits the latest fuel bill rises are disappointing. E.ON's putting its prices up by 3.7% for dual-fuel customers, which adds another £48 a year to the average bill. Thousands of people have been allowed back into their homes after last night's tidal surge flooded parts of England's east coast and North Wales. Jackie and Stephen Connolly lost their home when cliffs collapsed at Hemsby in Norfolk.
Managed to save a sofa and a three-piece suite, TV and video. Yeah. But then they turned around and said that everybody out.
And then everybody had to get out because...
And as we shut the patio doors, we actually saw the floor of the kitchen crack and go down.
That's the latest. I'm Simon English.
BCFM.
It's Friday, yes, it's 5 o'clock and BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. Helping us review this week's news is Labour councillor for Lawrence Hill, Hibak Jama. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, what if everything we thought we knew about politics was wrong? The people we saw year after year on our TV screen and read about in the newspapers are just marionettes, puppets of a much higher power operating behind the scenes for centuries, even since the dawn of time. Last week we heard about the sad death of wartime MI6 agent and author of Operation James Bond, the book who helped Hitler's treasurer escape at the end of World War II, his name John Ainsworth Davis. This week we conclude with a famous TV personality on rumours of Hitler's treasurer's secret life in South America. And we go back to the ill-fated battle of Operation Market Garden, September 1944, hearing Tory Foreign Secretary and Bilderberg Chairman Lord Carrington describe his role in halting his tanks for a 17-hour break, just as the British paratroopers in Arnhem needed him most. Plus, Germany on the rise, drones, nuclear subs, intelligence services, and an army that's now able to operate all over the world. What's now the strongest economy of Europe? Is it becoming dangerous once again? Plus, Martin Summers takes us on a tour of the world's hotspots, all in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 7 Celsius and dry. This weekend, highs of 10. Relatively cloudy weekend with hazy sunshine. Next week, highs of 10 again. Fairly sunny week. Little or no rain. Next weekend, that's the 14th and 15th of December. Highs around 9 Celsius and fairly cloudy. Still, little or no rain. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, joining us now is the councillor for Lawrence Hill, Labour councillor, in fact, Hibak Jama, for the first time. Hi, Hibak, welcome to Drive Time.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Now, first of all, what got you into politics, Hibak?
That's a very good question. My father was a... well, actually, I should start from the very beginning. My father and I first came to this country when I was 2 years old from Somalia, where there was a civil war. And my dad was an activist and sort of heavily involved in human rights, social justice, and those sorts of things, which the government at the time didn't care too much about, I suppose. When my father and I came here, he cared a lot about making sure that, you know, we weren't just here as non-active citizens, we were here as active citizens contributing to society, and not just contributing economically or socially, but contributing politically as well. And whilst he never sought to have a political career per se, he did influence political parties, he did campaign on issues that affected people, poor people, people with disabilities, people that were not represented. And I suppose I experienced a lot of that in my childhood. And so one of my earliest memories actually is my dad marching me off age 7 to Labour Party meetings where there were adults sat around discussing very important issues. And actually just being encouraged to talk about my views on education, my views on the welfare state and so on. So I guess I had a very early introduction into it. And I then went on to university and studied human rights law. And I think that gave me a good grounding for actually wanting to take the next step.
Well, what's your take on what's happening in Somalia? There's a big Somali community in Bristol, and I'd just like to know, from your point of view, what do you see the causes of the problems over there, and is there any prospect of a solution? Because they are obviously in quite an important, what the West sees as quite an important military zone, a lot of Western influence in that area, as they're one of the countries which is surrounding Iran. What are your thoughts about the causes and the possible solutions to the troubles in Somalia right now?
That's a very interesting question. It's a very big question, I have to say, not one that I have the absolute answer to, as I'm sure you will appreciate. In the main, I think that at the root of the issues in Somalia is severe poverty affecting a lot of people, and as is in this country and in many developing countries, but perhaps to a far greater extent, wealth concentrated in the hands of the few, wealth and power concentrated in the hands of the few, a lack of a legal state, and also the continuous breakdown of consecutive governments as well. There is also, you know, when you talk about Somalia, there are actually 5 different regions within what one may class as Somalia. There's Somaliland, which is in the north, which is a self-declared republic, which is relatively peaceful. Somalia, the traditional Somalia, has the capital Mogadishu, in and of itself is actually improving. There's the Somali federal government in place at the moment, which in my opinion is doing a good job, but has, you know, one hell of a job on their hands in terms of fighting piracy and fighting extremism in the form of Al-Shabaab.
Now, traditionally Africa has been, it's hideous to say this, but it's been a sort of plaything of the European powers. Do you think there's still a colonial element to the problems over there?
I think we live in an increasingly globalised world, and so inevitably there are decisions that are made here and elsewhere in the world that affects various African countries. And, you know, as we're seeing now on the news more and more, there are things happening in Somalia that are affecting us here in Bristol and around the world. And I think that, you know, to give an example of this increased globalisation, the double-edged sword that it is, the bombings in Kenya, Westgate, is an example of how turbulence and conflict can spill into other regions, and how actually we live in a world now where divisive ideology is rampant. And I think it's very, very dangerous, but nevertheless, I wouldn't classify it as an exclusively African problem. I think globalisation brings that.
What about your role in Bristol? I mean, you talked about coming in through your father into the Labour Party, so there's not much point in asking you why not one of the other parties. What is it about the Labour Party, though, that marks itself out as your party now that you think makes it different? Because many people say, and I must admit I agree with a lot of them, that some of the main issues to do with the economy, this sort of thing, the 3 main parties in this country, Conservatives, Liberal Democrats and Labour, all have the same policy.
A lot of people have said that to me, and a lot of people do hold that view. I think what I would say in response to that is I'd quote Tony Benn, who said that the Labour Party isn't a socialist party, it's a party with socialists in it. And like the church having some Christians in it, or like mosques that have Muslims in it, the Labour Party has socialists in it. It's not necessarily the party that bases everything it does and everything it says on socialism, but in my opinion it's a far better alternative than the other two main parties that we have.
The trouble with socialism, of course, is when things go wrong, when people get into power that are actually using the government to do things they shouldn't be. I mean, many people would say, for example, the invasion of Iraq, which was something that the Blair government was right behind, your party, was a totally illegal war and should never have happened. So socialism's all very well, but how do you make sure that the Socialist Party, the Labour Party that you're in, is actually doing what the people want, and rather than sort of kowtowing to a kind of globalisation agenda or a NATO agenda, a wider Western agenda?
Right, well, I've got to just pick you up on that.
Yeah.
I definitely have to pick you up on that. Insofar as attributing the atrocities in Iraq and the completely immoral war on Iraq to the current Labour Party, I think Ed Miliband's made his apologies. I think he's acknowledged that it was the wrong thing to do. And aside from the party itself, I, as an individual who first and foremost happens to be a member of the party and secondly happens to be an elected councillor that represents the party, can in no way take responsibility for the Iraq war. I was one of the many, many people that protested in London against the Iraq war. So I think it's important to state that first and foremost.
Okay, so something you distance yourself from. What makes us... I mean, because people will be thinking, if we elect the Labour Party again in 2015, what's to say that there's not going to be another sort of mistake like the Iraq War? I mean, you're part of the same party that made these mistakes back then. So, I mean, I suppose what we're doing is really going back to that question, is it looks like almost like there's a very good ideals, but when it comes to the actual results, sometimes it just doesn't work for us at the Labour Party.
That's true of any organisation. That's true of any collection of people. That's true of any ideology. I'm a member of the Labour Party because of the political parties that are out there. It is the party that suits and reflects my priorities and my opinions. but it's not right to say that the Labour Party has never made any mistakes in the past, and it's not right to say that it will never make any mistakes in the future. Yes, I happen to be a member of the Labour Party. I also happen to be a Muslim. And in my opinion, it's taking it one step too far to associate entire negativity with a particular organisation or collection of people.
Okay. Also, we heard the sad death about Nelson Mandela last night, age 95. As someone who's got a lot of connections with Africa, Hibak, what are your thoughts about the impact? One of the things I was just chatting to Pat before the news, we didn't hear that he was a communist. Very little discussion about the fact that he was. What are your thoughts about the impact of Nelson Mandela on the world today?
I think that we're in danger of, as we do quite often with our heroes, is sterilizing their image and making them this great pious figure that wasn't perhaps revolutionary. We're in danger of perhaps taking the bite out of the legacy through sterilization. And I think that we should be very careful to remember that actually Nelson Mandela in his time was not only a revolutionary man, but he was a radical man, and he sought to change the views and change the structures and systems that he confronted at his time, and he did that by any means necessary. And so I think for me that's what I take away from it, is that he wasn't simply a postcard figure, and he wasn't someone to just be held up and sort of praised. I think there's more to the man than just sort of saying what a fantastic man he was. There's a story there, there are lessons there, there's courage there, and there's something that a lot of people can take away and implement.
But don't you think that a lot of people on all political spectrums, maybe yourself included, actually distance themselves from his radical political ideas, the communism?
I think some people do. For me, I don't wish to sort of play party political games with the legacy of Nelson Mandela. What I do choose to do, however, is take his story, take his journey, take his wisdom, and interpret that and implement that in my life and in my decision making.
I mean, he was very big in this whole fact, helped launch Make Poverty History, the campaign, but certainly in Britain today we're not seeing that at all, are we? We're seeing more and more children in Britain growing up in poverty, in the tens of thousands just in London, and so it seems we've got a long way to go to live up to some of his ideals.
We certainly have got an awful long way to go. Just in Lawrence Hill, child poverty is staggering. Hearing case studies of children turning up to any number of the primary schools that we have in Lawrence Hill, and their parents haven't been able to feed them breakfast. It's stories like this, I think, that need to feature at the very top of our news items and news agendas.
What do you think can be done about it? I mean, this is the ultimate question, isn't it? What can we do to actually live out some of those ideals here in Britain and to relieve poverty for children? Because at the moment it's going in the opposite direction.
It is absolutely going in the opposite direction. Well, there are a number of things that we can do, and I think that it stems right the way from Whitehall and central government, right through to local authorities, right through to local communities, faith groups, organisations, collections of people, streets. We need to bring back this sense of community and this sense of tolerance and this sense of communal living, in the sense that we have a vested interest in our neighbours, we have a vested interest in their welfare and in their well-being. And it's interesting for me because, you know, a lot of the time I feel as though I am living a sort of a parallel life, in the sense that I understand the British culture, part of the British community, if you want to use those words, and I am also part of the Somali culture, and I understand that quite well. So I'm able to move freely through the two, and perhaps within the Somali culture there is more of a duty, if you like, more of a duty of care on the private citizen to take care of, look after, have a vested interest in the welfare of their neighbour, of their friend, of the elderly, and so on and so forth. I have lots of British friends and colleagues and neighbours and so on and so forth, and I don't see the same level of perhaps vested interest, duty of care, obligation, absolute obligation, to check on your other fellow humans. And it's that sense of community. You know, I think that culture is a very interesting thing, and every culture has great things about it that need to be shared. And I think that that's one thing that perhaps we could learn from the Somali culture. There's other things that we can learn about the British culture, an awful lot more we can learn about the British culture as well.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Apartheid, many would say, is actually, although over in South Africa, is alive and well in places like Israel, Palestine and Sri Lanka.
Well, I mean, it's not even over in South Africa, if you think about it. I mean, the economic injustices in South Africa remain as glaring as they were before.
Are you talking about a sort of social apartheid?
Well, yes. And the social conditions have improved in one way, in the sense that the state is not actively persecuting a majority of the population. But the social conditions for ordinary people are still pretty bad. I've got friends who live over there. And there's a lot of frustration that things have not really improved for the people at the bottom of the pile. And of course, South Africa, like all other developing countries, and it's quite a powerful developing country, it's part of the BRICS group with Brazil and Russia and India and China. But at the same time, they still get told what to do by the likes of the International Monetary Fund, who then determine their economic policy. Not entirely, but there's still an awful lot of forces at work which are not strictly to do with racial discrimination, but sort of social apartheid between those who have and those who have not. And that's strong in South Africa, it's strong everywhere.
Well, we'll talk a little bit more about social apartheid after we hear from Nelson himself. And here's a clip from one of the first, well, it was just the first few years of ITV. One of their reporters called Brian Widlake interviewed him when he was still a bit of a revolutionary and a very dangerous man.
Up to now, African nationalism has only made itself felt in campaigns of non-cooperation. Where there have been riots in locations like these, they've generally been caused by bad conditions. 2 days before South Africa became a republic, a stay-away strike was organized throughout the country in protest. But most Africans went to work. 10,000 of them were arrested before the strike began. The army was fully mobilized, and an African knows he can be jailed for 3 years if he dares to strike. I went to see the man who organized this stay-away, a 42-year-old African lawyer, Nelson Mandela, the most dynamic leader in South Africa today. The police were hunting for him at the time, but African nationalists had arranged for me to meet him at his hideout. He is still underground. This is Mandela's first television interview. I asked him what it was that the African really wanted.
The Africans require, want the franchise on the basis of one man, one vote. They want political independence.
Do you see Africans being able to develop in this country without the European being pushed out?
We have made it very clear in our policy that South Africa is a country of many races. There is room for all the various races in this country.
Are there many educated Africans in South Africa?
Yes. We have a large number of Africans who are educated and who are taking part in the political struggles of the African people. The question of education has nothing to do with the question of the vote. On numerous occasions, it has been proved in history that people can enjoy the vote even if they have no education. Of course, we desire education, and we think it's a good thing. But you don't have to have education in order to know that you want certain fundamental rights, you have got aspirations, you have got claims. It has nothing to do with education whatsoever.
Are you planning any more campaigns of non-cooperation?
Yes. The Peter Maritzburg resolution makes provision for a campaign of non-cooperation with the government, and we are presently studying plans to implement this aspect of the resolution.
Now, if Dr. Verwoerd's government doesn't give you the kind of concessions that you want sometime soon, is there any likelihood of violence?
There are many people who feel that the reaction of the government to our stay-at-home, ordering a general mobilization, arming the white community, arresting 10,000 of Africans, the show of force throughout the country, notwithstanding our clear declaration that this campaign is being run on peaceful and non-violent lines, close the chapter as far as our methods of political struggle are concerned. There are many people who feel that it is useless and futile for us to continue talking peace and non-violence against a government whose reply is only savage attacks on an unarmed and defenseless people. And I think the time has come for us to consider, in the light of our experiences in this stay-at-home, whether the methods which we have applied so far are adequate.
ITV's Brian Widlake talking to Nelson Mandela there way back in 1961. Martin, this man is a black African terrorist. How come he's so revered now?
Well, I mean, when you say he was a terrorist, he said that the ANC would not renounce the armed struggle. And that's one of the reasons why he was sent to prison at Rivonia. But, I mean, that's fairly... I mean, how many people out there in Radio Land or in Britain are pacifists? If somebody's occupying your country and killing your people, what would you do?
Well, I mean, you know, would you refer that to, say, places like Afghanistan and Iraq? Is it justified to kill British troops who are occupying those
countries? Well, whatever we think, certain people in those countries certainly think that it is, and possibly a majority. How are we to know? that's what happens when the Germans were occupying most of Europe. The British special intelligence services were quite happy for those people to go around blowing things up and shooting people. That's the real world.
Now, one of the first people, if not the first person, to sign the book of condolence at the South African embassy in Trafalgar Square was David Cameron. But it's interesting to see that he had a freebie trip to apartheid South Africa right at the height of the ban, really. I mean, he admitted his party had got it wrong, though, over sanctions when he later visited Mandela. David Cameron accepted an all-expenses-paid trip to apartheid South Africa while Nelson Mandela was still in prison. An updated biography of the Tory leader reveals today a trip by Mr. Cameron in 1989, when he was a rising star of the Conservative Research Department, was a chance for him to see for himself, and was funded by a firm that lobbied against the imposition of sanctions on the apartheid regime. Critics described it as a sanction-busting jolly that raised questions about the character of the man who, after a week when the government's credibility on the economy hit a new low, this is back in April 2009, was on course to be Prime Minister in a little more than a year's time.
Yeah, that trip in 1989 is quite interesting because two other people were on that trip. One was Sir Kenneth Warren, who most people won't have heard of, but he's a rather important fundraiser for the Conservative Party and has been for many years, a sort of a money man. And the other third person on that trip was Dr. David Kelly. And the purpose of the trip was to go to Arms
this
Corps.
This is the government scientist who died in 2003 in suspicious
the very same one.
Circumstances.
So there were three people on this delegation: Dr. David Kelly, Sir Kenneth Warren, and David Cameron, who is a 20-something from Conservative Central Office. And information we've been receiving suggests that there was a deal being cooked up. South Africa had 9 nuclear weapons. They originally had 10 nuclear weapons, which they developed at Pelindaba with the Israelis. One of them was exploded over the South Atlantic. That left 9 nuclear weapons. It's like 10 green bottles, isn't it, this story? Anyway, as the changes were about to take place in South Africa, the Magnus Malan, who was the defence minister, Arms Corps, which was the their equivalent of BAE Systems, and they basically went to the West via an intermediary called John Bradenkamp, who was an ex-Rhodesian SAS operative, but was now actually a major arms dealer. People can look him up on the internet and they will find him. He actually lives in Kilmersdown in Somerset now. But basically they did a deal. They said, we don't want Nelson Mandela and the ANC to have these 9 nuclear warheads. So
this is actually the white South African government saying that, well, since the country's going over to black majority rule, we think that they shouldn't have access to these secret nuclear weapons we've got.
Yeah, because otherwise Nelson Mandela would have got his finger on the nuclear button as soon as he won the election. That wasn't acceptable to the white South African elite, and it wasn't acceptable to the Western powers either. So they did a deal whereby these 9 nuclear warheads, which were uranium-based nuclear warheads, were sold to the Western powers, 6 to the Americans and 3 to the British. But what happened, the American warheads were loaded at Durban and taken to the US and dismantled. The 3 British warheads, and this is what the delegation, we suspect this delegation was about, they weren't sold to the British government directly. A private company called Astra Holdings, which was actually a subsidiary of Astra Fireworks, if people remember them, they set up by a chap called Stephen Koch, who used to be an MI6 officer. They bought the 3 warheads, as it were, on the black market from Arms Corps, and then sold them on to the British government for £50 million. And Margaret Thatcher, one of the last things she did as she left office was sign a payment order for £50 million to Astra Holdings for these 3 warheads. But the warheads, of course, they had bought them from the South African government at much less than £50 million. And those who were involved in this scam got basically a profit from it, including the Conservative Party itself, which made £17.8 million to fund the 1992 general election.
Now, it's a pretty shocking accusation, Martin. Also,
well, I've made
people
it before,
can find it.
You know.
People can find it online. It's an article by Peter Eyre. It's probably the best one to find. You can find EYRE on his own blog or on the Palestine Telegraph website about this whole story. But what evidence have you got for it?
Well, I'm getting evidence from people who were involved. So they're talking to me I can't say who, because they've signed the Official Secrets Act. But in any case, as you say, if people want to check this story for themselves, they can find it on Palestine Telegraph or Peter Ayres.
I mean, this 17 million donation, for example, is there any evidence for that?
Yes, there is. Doug Hoyle, the Labour MP, had been tipped off about this, and it's in Hansard. He made a question in the House of Commons. I can't remember what the year was. It was in the 1990s. Say, well, where did this £17.8 million come from? And there was a sort of bluff, we can't possibly tell you, you'll have to look into it. But anyway, I mean, that's a lot of money. I mean, even in banker terms, £17.8 million is not peanuts, and in political terms, it's quite a large amount of money.
Oh, certainly.
Possibly could have made the difference between major losing or winning the election, for example.
Well, certainly a fascinating twist to David Cameron's trip.
There's a further twist to the story, of course, which is that the warheads themselves then went missing. They lost them.
Well, how did they get the money for this 17 million then?
They went round Tory party donors and asked them to chip in to the pot, and then all of these people would then be paid back, and they were paid back. We've been given a list of people who actually made a lot of money out of this.
Okay, fascinating angle on it all. But anyway, let's go back to Westminster now. And this week we had some slight shift in the power structure up at Westminster. We had Harriet Harman, the deputy leader of the Labour Party, at Prime Minister's Questions with the Deputy Prime Minister, Nick Clegg.
Harriet Harman.
Can I join the Deputy Prime Minister in conveying our deepest sympathy to the families of the 9 people who lost their lives in the tragic accident in Glasgow? I join him in paying tribute to the brave work of the emergency services and to the quite remarkable response of the people of Glasgow. Mr. Speaker, can the Deputy Prime Minister tell us, compared to last winter, will this winter's household energy bills be lower or higher?
Mr. Speaker, they would be higher if we had not taken the action that we have. And I would simply point out to her that her party's economically illiterate policy is to impose. In fact, her energy spokesperson said just 2 days ago on television, well, you can't control energy prices. So there we have it.
Martin, economically illiterate.
Well, I mean, to be honest with you, this government, in my mind, are economically illiterate. And that sort of charge just makes me laugh. I mean, all of this stuff, the front bench of the Tory party and the Liberal party have been coming out with, everybody knows who has got a credit card or who runs a household that you can't spend what you haven't earned and that you've got to balance the books.
Well, that's what he's doing. This is what Osborne's doing.
Yes, but I'll just have to point out, as a teacher, former teacher of economics, that is actually just not the case. It sounds plausible. In actual fact, the advanced level economics, which you start learning in your late teens, is that in actual fact you don't have to balance the books, and attempts to balance the books are often misguided, and that's one of the first things you have to teach 16 and 17 year olds about economics. But apparently it's news to David Cameron and George Osborne.
Hibak Jama, Labour councillor for Lawrence Hill. People are suffering, aren't they, right now with increased bills. We had E.ON as well putting their bills up over winter. It's almost as if as winter comes along and everyone is getting worried about heating bills and having to turn up the heating for winter, so the energy companies turn up their prices.
They certainly are, and I'd just like to reiterate Martin's point about economics and just how absurd it is to hear George Osborne talking about economics and the illiterate economic policy, if you like, of the Labour Party.
Well, the reason he's saying
rather
that
rich.
Is because he's looking back at 2008 and saying Labour was in charge when the banks nearly collapsed and we had to bail them out. And that massive debt is now crippling the country.
Well, in terms of Lawrence Hill and in terms of the people that are actually bearing the full brunt of the energy crisis that we're in, and you make no mistake about it, we are in an energy crisis. £50 off a heating bill isn't very much and isn't going to go a long way to solve the cost of living crisis that an awful lot of people are having to face in the ward that I represent, Lawrence Hill. More to the point, in Lawrence Hill, like in many major cities that we have in the UK, we have tower blocks. great many tower blocks which haven't actually been very well built. And so with these tower blocks, insulation is a huge problem, meaning that the poorest people in society are having to pay the most when it comes to their energy costs. If we took a leaf out of the Swedish book and we actually invested an awful lot more in how we insulate houses when we build them, that would A, increase the savings for the customer, and B, that would actually save an awful lot of lives, because as you and I both know, winter is just around the corner. And actually, if you look at the death, if you look at the weather-related death rates in the UK, they're far higher than they need to be. And so this is a crisis. And unfortunately, I'm not seeing the coalition government talking about this an awful lot more. They're not talking about it in detail. And I would like to see this be a major priority.
Well, the Labour Party, Ed Miliband, the former climate change minister, is saying that he wants to see an energy freeze. But the trouble is that isn't going to work, is it? As soon as the it would work if he didn't announce it beforehand and did it when he was Prime Minister. But now the energy companies know he plans to do it just before the next election. They're going to put their prices up again, aren't they?
No, I think it's important that he did it. I think it's important that he did it for two reasons. One, it actually gives hope to the British public. It gives them a real vision and a real sense that there is a leader amongst the three leaders of the different political parties that understands that this needs to be challenged head on and that understands that this needs to be tackled. Secondly, it actually shines the light on David Cameron and exposes him to... It exposes the fact that of all the things he's willing to do, the thing he's least willing to do of all is actually stand up to the energy companies. So I think it's important that he announced it. I'm incredibly proud that he announced it. And I think politically, it was a very, very smart move, I have to say.
Martin, the fact of the matter is that most of our politicians now are former public relations people. They're just, many people say David Cameron's just doing PR as Prime Minister for the energy cartels.
Well, you may say that, and that's a bit of an underarm from my point of view. I would say yes, but I think the real problem underlying all of this is that these industries should never have been in the private sector in the first place.
Well, you can't rewrite history. They are. You have to deal with things as they are.
No.
You can't say, oh, we're... What
no, no, as an economist, I would like to say, when we've had a massive crisis like this, where the banks have nearly collapsed, where the states had to step in and bail out the private sector, I think we are entitled to discuss the underlying economics of the situation.
Well, yes,
the underlying
economics. What we want to hear is how you actually fix it, because what we always hear is there's no money to nationalise
institutions. I'll tell you how you fix it. What they've done in Venezuela with the energy sector, for example, and of course this has never happened in places like Norway, where it's always been in the public sector. If you've got a private sector which is rapacious and being run by oligarchs and criminals, what you do is you start to regulate them. And you regulate them so tightly that they can't make any profit. And if they're still making a profit, you regulate them tighter again until they can't make a profit. And eventually they get to a point where they can't make a profit doing it. And then what do they have to do? They have to give it back to
but
you
they use
for
their
nothing.
Profits to lobby government, so they don't...
That's why you regulate them, to make sure that they can't use their profits to lobby government,
but
to get more money.
But if it looks like something like that's going to happen, then they spend loads of money on lawyers trying to make sure
you understand, as Hibak pointed out, what Ed Miliband has done. It is quite a... what they call in rugby league a 60-20, he's opened the debate. And by opening the debate, he's forced the government onto the defensive, and they have to justify everything that's happening. And this has actually gone on for several weeks now, as winter closes in, and the government is having to discuss the absolutely shocking stats, as Hibak pointed out, of people in this country who die from not having sufficient heating.
Well, I noticed David Cameron...
Doesn't happen in Norway.
Well, rather than admit it in public, he's been sneakily talking to the energy companies behind the scenes, hasn't he, saying, please will you...
Well, interestingly enough, the energy companies have been sneakily talking to the Labour Party behind the scenes, because they know that we are going to be the next government. And what was very interesting when Ed Miliband brought this up is that the shares in these companies went down on the stock exchange, and that means that all of the traders and the people in the city know who the next government's going to be, as do the bookmakers, Paddy Power, William Hill and all the rest of it. It's odds on a Labour majority of 80-90, and at this point in the stage in the game, the powerful are now leaning on the Labour Party to try and get what they want. They're beating a path to the Labour Party's door to discuss with our people about how it's going to be. And that's because we're going to win.
Well, maybe. Maybe not. Another point that came up at Prime Minister's Questions this week with Harriet Harman and Nick Clegg was the issue of Royal Mail and the £2 billion, that's £40 per man, woman and child in the entire country, that we were sold short over Royal Mail.
Isla Stewart.
My honourable friend for Glasgow North wanted to know whether the British taxpayer got value for money on the sale of Royal Mail. Yes or no?
Speaker, our judgment is yes, that that easy though it might be to make snapshot judgments about the value of the company according to the price on the markets in any one day. We, on this issue, as on so many other issues, are determined to take a long-term view, not score short-term political points.
Here back, the minute that Royal Mail shares were traded on the London Stock Exchange, they leapt by £2 billion in value. That's £2 billion that everybody in the country lost when Goldman Sachs and the rest of them launched that share issue. I mean, how have we allowed this kind of thing to happen?
It's very simple. We didn't allow this very thing to happen. The Conservative Party and the Liberal Democrat Party in coalition government together made, to quote Nick Clegg, which I very rarely do, a snap judgment that was based in the interests of their very powerful, very well-off backers, donors and friends, and not in the interests of the wider British public.
They're talking next privatisation is going to be uranium, the British the government stake in the uranium companies. Do you think that might go a bit better or worse?
I don't agree with privatisation. I'm very much in favour of nationalising the core services that we have in Britain. Will that go any better? Based on experience, based on this situation with Royal Mail, I won't be holding my breath.
Okay, Martin, Royal Mail, £2 billion we've lost in this share issue.
Yeah, and there's a fundamental point that this shouldn't have been privatised in the first place.
Well, I mean Labour were talking about it, weren't they?
Well, I know. I think Hibak would agree with me that in some respects the Labour Party in the past was too subservient to the neoliberal ideology. It was we all believed in the market until the market crashed, and then suddenly all these idiots realised, actually, we don't believe in the market, do we? And we've had 5 years since that market crash, and we're still hearing the same old privatisation is good, deregulation is what we need more competition, and all of this stuff. It's just parrot fashion stuff. I mean, the last 5 years surely should have demonstrated to people that stuff is dead. It's history. It's history. Unfortunately, it's not history. We're still going on with it. And what most people don't realise about the Royal Mail privatisation is that the pension liabilities of Royal Mail, which had been built up because the company wasn't paying in the good years, wasn't paying into the pension pot because they were using it for operating costs, that has been handed to the taxpayer. So we've not just lost on the actual sale, the pensions, which will carry on being paid by the taxpayer for decades to come, that has been given to the public sector to sort out. Now, if you were going to privatise a business like that, you should privatise the pension liabilities as well, and at that point nobody would want to buy it. So the profitable bit has been sold for profit, for private profit, and the loss-making bit has been taken over by the taxpayer. So the loss to the general public is far higher than we're being told.
Well, it sounds like more debt, for not only just for individuals and families, also for the state and the country.
Indeed.
They're just piling debt upon debt upon debt. Anyway, the autumn statement is supposed to sort all this out, isn't it? We have the budget early in the year and towards the end of the year. It's not actually autumn, it's well into winter now. It may be few problems agreeing what they were going to say. So let's have a listen now to a little extract from George Osborne's autumn statement this week.
Our reforms to student loans, difficult as they were, have put our universities on a secure footing. Now, some predicted that applications from students from poor backgrounds would fall. Instead, I can report that this year we have had the highest proportion of young people from disadvantaged backgrounds applying to university ever. But there is still a cap on aspiration. Each year, around 60,000 young people who have worked hard at school, got the results, want to go on learning, and want to take out a loan to pay for it are prevented from doing so because of an arbitrary cap. That makes no sense when we have a lower proportion of people going to university than even the United States, let alone countries like South Korea. Access to higher education is a basic tenet of economic success in the global race. So today I can announce that next year we will provide 30,000 more student places, and the year after we will abolish the cap on student numbers altogether. Yeah. extra funding will be provided to science, technology and engineering courses. The new loans will be financed by selling the old student loan book, allowing thousands more to achieve their potential. Mr. Speaker, education underpins opportunity. It is business that provides those opportunities. And the best way to help business is by lowering the burden of tax. KPMG's report last week confirmed for the second year running that Britain has the most competitive business tax system in the world.
Okay. Oh, KPMG are being mentioned there. Yes, the people that were. What was the particular thing that they were?
They signed off the accounts of HBOS.
Oh yes, they did. They did, didn't they? You remind me. There's so much criminality there that I've forgotten what each particular institution is supposed to have done.
Also, their senior partner who was trading confidential client information for Rolex watches and big bags of cash.
The fundamental point that George Osborne was making there, that business succeeds with low taxes. I just point across the North Sea to Scandinavia, particularly to Norway, where in actual fact they've got an increasing number of people employed in manufacturing in Norway, which actually defies what's going on in the rest of the developed world. They have very high taxes, and the government has just changed to the right in Norway for the first time since 1945. Possibly the new government in Norway are going to make a mess of it. But frankly, the real model for Britain isn't Hong Kong and Singapore. It's Norway and Finland, and Norway and Finland are basically, Northern European countries. On the basis of Finland, their education system is very, very liberal. They have small class sizes, mixed ability teaching, no tests or exams until people are 18, and they came sixth in the international league tables.
Yeah, well, Osborne came
26th.
Osborne there was talking about selling a student loan book.
What that means, of course, the student loan problem with the student loan thing is quite a lot of students never earn enough to pay it back. So this rather undermines the finances of the university sector. And then, of course, selling the student loan book means that basically very aggressive debt collectors are going to be chasing people for that money. Now, if what George Osborne said at the beginning of that is true, that education is the key to success in the modern world, why are you pushing the price up by making everybody pay more and more for it?
So you're saying,
why don't you subsidise it?
Students
so
in
important?
Their mid-20s who maybe have only got a part-time job are going to have the bailiffs come around trying to take their car off them.
Well, or even people like my sister are in their 40s who still haven't paid off their student loans. What you've got to remember is a lot of people go to a university to get educated, and they don't in fact go into the City of London to earn loads of money. They go on to be nurses and teachers, often teachers in inner city schools and so on, and they never earn a large amount of money, but they're still contributing to society. Archaeology contributes a lot to this country, but none of them make a lot of money out of it.
Now, before we hear from Hibak on the autumn statement, let's hear from Ed Balls, the Labour Shadow Chancellor. And fellow Bilderberger, of course, with George Osborne.
Mr. Ed Balls!
Mr. Speaker, the whole country will have seen today that for all his boasts and breathtaking complacency, for order. Don't need any sedentary comments from either side of the House, just as I said in respect of the Chancellor. Courtesy, please. Ed Balls.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The whole country will have seen today that for all his boasts and utterly breathtaking complacency, the Chancellor is in complete denial about the central fact which is defining this government in office. Under this Chancellor and this Prime Minister, for most people in our country, living standards aren't rising, Mr. Speaker. They are falling year on year on year. So let me ask the Chancellor to demonstrate. He didn't mention it. Let me ask him to demonstrate he is not completely out of touch with the cost of living crisis facing millions of people in our country. Can he confirm that on average, working people in our country are £1,600 a year worse off than when they came into government in 2010?
That's Ed Balls there, the Shadow Chancellor, responding to George Osborne, the Chancellor's autumn statement. Now, Hitback, he's really focusing there on the cost of living crisis, and interesting to see that Ipsos Mori did a poll the afternoon of the autumn statement this week, which said that the public is backing Ed Balls over Osborne following this autumn statement. 47% of those who had an opinion on the autumn statement believed it would benefit the rich, while just 14% thought it would benefit the poor. 44% of people thought it would have a negative impact on the poor. So Ed Balls might have taken a battering at the Commons, but a new poll shows the public backed him over Osborne.
They certainly did, and with good cause too. There is a cost of living crisis. The majority of people living in our country are not wealthy multimillionaires. They are ordinary people, the likes of which Martin has mentioned. And for those people, there is a very real crisis. There is a very real crisis in their lives, and it is getting increasingly difficult. And where the Chancellor and the Prime Minister fall, in my opinion, is that they don't seem to grasp the concept that where there is a cost of living crisis, it will show up elsewhere in the public purse, be it through the mental health, be it through the criminal justice system, or be it through increasing demand on public services. So I completely, naturally, as you would expect, agree with Ed Balls.
I mean, one of the things that I find so frustrating about things like the autumn statement is these big macroeconomic figures sound good. I mean, we're turning the corner, things are getting better. But this is, it seems completely out, nothing to do with the way people are feeling on the ground. In fact, the opposite.
It is the complete opposite. And unfortunately, they do appear to be very out of touch. It's interesting that the Labour Party at the moment nationally is definitely leading the agenda on this cost of living crisis and on the energy issue as well. And at the moment, for me and for a great many people, not only in Bristol but in the United Kingdom as well, the coalition government doesn't seem to be responding very well to some of the questions and some of the assertions that are being put to them.
Martin, one of the things also is we keep hearing the recovery is sort of disappearing ahead of us. It's almost like one of those cartoons from when I was watching children at the children's TV, where it's constantly receding. It always seems to be 4 years in the future, this recovery. Also, a very important part of the autumn statement was this welfare cap. Now, this is the writing on the walls here, the end of welfare, possibly, if the Conservatives have their way.
I think it's quite interesting because both David Cameron and George Osborne have come out in the last few weeks. But when they first came to power, they said, I think David Cameron said, nobody goes into politics to cut. And I'm just doing this because we've got no choice. That wasn't true, in fact. We had choices even then. But he made a speech in the City of London, in the Guildhall, to the elite of the city, and he said, we've got to actually make austerity permanent, and we've got to shrink the welfare state. So a welfare cap saying we're only going to spend so much on housing benefit and unemployment benefit. I would have to say, well, hang on a minute. This isn't discretionary. The number of people who need housing benefit, which is at the moment a legal right, is whatever it is. The number of unemployed is whatever it is. You are obliged to pay those people, according to existing setups, a certain amount of money. And you can't actually say in advance how much you're going to spend on it. It depends what happens, doesn't it? And when this is what's called fiscal stabilisers in the economy. So that when the economy is growing too fast, if you've got a progressive tax system, more money is taken out of the economy as people go into higher tax brackets. And that slows down the inflationary pressure of your boom, which is good because it stabilises the ship. And when the economy is going downhill, as it has been for the last few years, although it seems to have turned the corner now, fingers crossed, then it actually boosts the economy if you increase benefit payments rather than cutting benefit payments. And you'll notice that in Iceland, far from cutting unemployment benefits, the democratic government which came to power after the crisis increased unemployment benefits.
Okay.
And that's actually good for the economy.
Finally this week, Marina Morris has been out on the streets to ask you. We had a statement the other week from Pope Francis saying that he thought capitalism was the new tyranny. So what are the people of Bristol? What do you think?
The Pope Francis said, capitalism is a new tyranny. When the rich refuse to give to the poor, it is theft. Do you agree?
It's a very strong statement to make, isn't it? I don't think you can make a statement like that and agree with it entirely, because Western society is based on capitalism, and there's good aspects to that. It gives people jobs, it gives people prosperity, so there's nothing wrong with that. It's clear that sometimes when people become rich and famous and have a lot of power, that they can misuse that sort of power in some ways. There's a lot of unfairness, there's a lot of injustice. You can't blame it just on capitalism, no. I think that's human beings that are to blame for that.
It's a difficult one, because a lot of people work hard all their lives and sort of work hard for the money they've got, and a lot of poor people in this country don't necessarily work and have an attitude of sort of waiting for money to come to them, and an attitude that they should have as much money. But then on the other hand, there are those rich people who are sort of born into money and sort of neglect the fact that a lot of poor people are present in this country. So, but I think that's quite an outrageous statement to say.
In some respects, it's a shame that money can be used in other respects to help. I think there's some things that are funded that maybe necessarily don't need to be and could be helped for use people that are in need of it. So to a degree, I think I probably agree, yeah.
If the rich earned earned the money through like getting their education and saved up that money, then it's really their money, to be fair. That people should be donating money to the poor, because obviously they need the help.
Also because people have their own religions to follow as well. So in their religions it says to at least quarter or half of your money that you earn, give to charity.
The poor need it more than the rich. The money is just extra for them to satisfy their own desires.
Very strong words. First of all, I'm not sure that it's a new tyranny. I think capitalism has been something that we've all had to cope with and live with for generations. It's a bit extreme, to be honest, to say that when the rich refuse to give to the poor, it's theft. I don't agree with that. It's too strongly worded. But I do agree that more needs to be done to help the poor. In terms of charitable donations and more favourable rules and laws applicable to the making of gifts, benefits to charity, I think.
Is UK politics moral enough?
Most probably not. Again, down to society. The UK political system is governed by political parties that are very involved in one another. They've been involved in what they did at school, what they did at university, and you only need to look at the Conservative Party as it stands. And they were at school together, they were at university together, and it's a little club, basically, and that's not good. You need diversity in life and diversity in politics as well. Bristol's a great place, by the way. We've got a great Lord, we've got a great mayor who's very independent, and he's not involved in any of this capitalism stuff. He just basically makes decisions based on what's good for Bristol. So that's a good model to run out on the country, I would say.
The thing I've found is that sort of every party, sort of, they're all conflicting against each other, obviously, and they all promise, they all have these things, these policies. None of them, it all ends up the same, because the population of the UK are expecting some radical change just by voting in a new party, and that's not the problem.
Most people would agree that UK politics, for all its faults, sets the standard for politics across other countries. I think other countries look at our politics and take the view theirs is the model. In summary, I think it is moral enough, yes.
Hey, back, do you think this is Britain is the capitalism is a new tyranny?
I think unregulated capitalism can be a form of tyranny. I think what's really interesting about those clips that you just aired was that actually this creation, if you like, of the deserving poor and the undeserving poor, this concept is so divisive and so dangerous as an ideology. Because ultimately, if you follow the argument all the way round and back again, it comes to the fundamental question of what sort of a country do you want to live in?
Okay.
And there are various people that obviously make gripes about paying into the
wealth. I have to wind you up there, I'm afraid, because it's time for the Murdoch News at 6. That was this week's guest, Labour Councillor for Lawrence Hill, Hibak Jama, right in the middle of making a point. But anyway, we'll be back after the news with a look at politics. Are they all just marionettes, these politicians?
BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 6, the South African President Jacob Zuma.